You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Good afternoon. My name is Mona Yacoubian. I'm the Vice President for the Middle East and North Africa here at USIP. It is my great pleasure to welcome you to this panel on how agriculture contributes to peace. So I know in the first panel, there was quite a lot of exploration of some of the overlapping issues and challenges between a changing global climate, food security, and conflict. So a lot of focus on challenges and problems. We are the fun panel. We are going to talk about solutions. We're going to be fun in a lot of ways, but this panel is going to really focus on solutions, and in particular how we can encourage climate resilient agriculture as a tool to ensure food secure communities and mitigate the risks against of violent conflict. We have a wonderful panel assembled here this afternoon to shed light on some of the innovative solutions that are being developed. I will introduce the panel, starting with to my immediate left, Ann Vaughn, who is Deputy Assistant Administrator in USAID's Bureau for Resilience, Environment, and Food Security. Next to Ann is Katie Crosby, Senior Director for U.S. Policy and Advocacy at Mercy Corps. And finally, all the way over, last but certainly not least, Matt Nims, who is Director of the Washington Office of the World Food Program. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have all of you here. I've had the great pleasure of working with each of you in a variety of contexts, so it's lovely to have you together. So what we thought we would do this afternoon is delve into several areas. We're going to look at fragility. We're going to look at innovation. We're going to look at local solutions and locally led initiatives. We're going to touch on post-conflict recovery and also look a bit at partnerships and collaboration. But I also want to assure you, we are going to leave 15 minutes at the end for your questions and comments. So we want to be sure that we draw you into the conversation as well. So with that, let's start with the big picture. And Anne, I'd like to start with you, if I could. Can you kick us off and paint a picture of what it is that USAID is doing to build communities that are resilient to climate shocks? What are some of the innovations that you're seeing on the ground that are starting to really have an impact in the communities where USAID works?
Sure. Thanks so much, Mona. Great to be here. Great to be on this fun panel. So we'll keep it positive. I won't dive into all of the more challenging climate risks and threats that the communities are facing that I think other panels were covering. But I want us to get excited about policy. So USAID really moves the needle when we put policies and strategies on the table, and then we're responsible as an agency or as a government to sort of meet those strategies and targets. And we have a really ambitious climate strategy that looks at kind of immediate. We have a strategic I'm getting nerdy right now, but I promise it'll get to the fun stuff. It's sort of the strategic objective of what we need to do right now to deal with the climate impacts that are impacting communities, women, children, families all around the world. And then we realized, when we were drafting the strategy, we need systems-level change to be able to address these big impacts, these longer droughts, longer droughts, more extreme weather that communities are facing. And we know one of the systems that we need to really look at is in food systems. So we've focused on how do we help sort of support communities in those systems. That's with our climate strategy. And then we did our global food security strategy, which is mandated by Congress through the Global Food Security Act, did a really good job at addressing and telling us, hey guys, you need to look at cross-cutting results that look at both conflict, we'll get to that later, but also in climate, how do we adapt? Because, oh my gosh, the impacts that farmers are facing right now, especially in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia and some of the countries that we work in, they are most impacted by climate change. But if you look at something called the ND Gain Index, their countries have the least capacity to be able to deal with those threats. So I'll dive into some of the solutions. So we have these big strategies that steer us in the right direction. Some of the investments that we've made We are one of the core partners and investors in the CGIAR. This is a food security audience, so I don't think I need to tell you about the CGIAR. But it's there's been research done that says through investments in this global agricultural research platform, basically get a 1 in 10 return on investments for all of those innovations that we have to make sure seeds are better. Cows are able, like right now they're looking at how do we breed cows more resistant to heat? Because so you don't have cow, you know, your livestock and all the billion people that depend on pastoralism around the world able to survive in much more warmer and extreme climates. And then through our, we're very proud of our Feed the Future Innovation Labs. So these are 20 labs around the United States that are U.S. universities and partners with other U.S. universities and partners overseas who help address problems on the ground and increasingly are looking at what are those innovations, what are those challenges that climate is causing, because that's what the problem sets that are coming to our innovation labs from communities around the world and our missions around the world. And I'll give one example that I think is, we'll probably talk about water scarcity a little bit later, I would imagine, but we just launched a Feed the Future Innovation Lab at University of Nebraska that looks at irrigation and small-scale mechanization. Because if you know, if you've been in sub-Saharan Africa, I think it's about 90-95% of farmers there are dependent on rain-fed agriculture. If the rains are changing and you don't know when to plant, you are out of luck and your family's gonna be hungry all year long. So we're working on irrigation, and also if you've ever worked in the dry quarter in Central America, that is very challenging. Our innovation lab is working in Honduras and Guatemala right now with Catholic Relief Services and examining how do we get women to use irrigation more? What are those technologies that are needed to really make sure that we're able to help communities adapt to address some of these challenges?
So with that sort of strategic vantage point, that level of strategy, Katie, I want to turn to you now and talk a little bit about how Mercy Corps views this. And there was an interesting quote that was shared with me that at Mercy Corps, the food security approach strategy really asserts that food security is a development outcome, not a sector. And so can you talk a little bit more about what that means? What does a multi-sector approach to food security look like?
Yeah, well, thank you, Mona, and everybody else on the panel. And I think that in terms of turning the page a bit on this panel from the problems to the solutions, I think that Anne has already set up kind of a lot of the different pieces of multi-sectoral approach that we have, both in terms of the food insecurity and then how we seek to create that food security. As we've seen, food insecurity, both chronic and acute, is a result of systemic constraints on behavior, which are only compounded by many other interventions, as we've seen and as we are discussing now, particularly climate and conflict. So conversely, food security emerges when multiple areas converge. We love a good Venn diagram at Mercy Corps. We're always a yes and organization, sometimes at our peril, but we really do see food security as a convergence of conditions that allow people to look to both their immediate needs as well as their long-term resilience and future capacity. So, for example, a couple of things that might look like is that we can support pro-poor market systems to supply nutritious foods at affordable prices. And I'm sure there are folks in here who've worked on, you know, fresh sweet potatoes and other grains that are more nutritious in the marketplace. And we can also, you know, provide effective governance of natural resource management to improve the natural resource base and improve the ecological systems that will provide more sustainable and reliable ag production. However, if we add in a gender component where we are empowering women to look for their own capacity and be able to purchase those nutritious foods in those markets for their families, you are seeing a multiplier effect and going from an individual outcome to a communal outcome. I think one of the examples that Mercy Corps has seen in this is our multi-sectoral approach in our Nwiri program, which is in northern Kenya. And on the face of it, it's a nutrition program. But you could probably, I could talk about Nwiri for about 3 hours without directly referencing nutrition because of the multi-sectoral nature and the different approaches. So what, in addition to the fresh fruits and vegetables and demonstration plots, as well as malnutrition screening done at an individual level, which are, you know, the bread and butter components of a lot of food security programs, it also looks at improved water management by communities. It looks at connecting smallholder farmers from tertiary markets to larger scale production capacity and distribution. I got sucked into my post Mercy Corps dream of becoming goat aggregator in northern Kenya by looking at the ways in which our teams were able to aggregate goats and other small ruminants in markets that would then improve the both purchasing power as well as the resilience of not those just those individuals, but those communities. And so I think that that's how a small snapshot of what we mean when we say multi-sectoral food security.
So, Matt, I want to sort of pick up on one of the points, Katie, that you made about sort of building individual well-being leading up to sort of more stable, resilient communities. And Matt, from your vantage point at the World Food Program, can you speak to some of the innovative work that WFP is doing to bolster social cohesion and resolve differences both within and between communities? Because we are, of course, trying to, again, bring in the connection to peace building as well. And I think WFP and some of the very innovative work WFP has led is going to be offer us an important example of that.
First of all, I just want to say thanks for the invitation. I've yet to come to USIP. Oh. I know that's really horrible, but it's really neat to be here, and I haven't been inside, so if I'm staring off into space, I'll try to focus a little bit more. So glad to be here. I guess I do want to caveat, like, innovative for WFP does not necessarily mean innovative in general, because sometimes, and I actually think this goes across sectors, things that are employed and then not employed and then employed again. I think there's a cycle that exists out there. Yeah, and I think that that's important. And so I don't want to put any ownership on this from the WFP side or actually from any of our sides, because I think a lot of these things were learned a long time ago, but maybe not used effectively or appropriately or even with enough time. In the particular context of food security in these communities with conflict and fragility, I think a deeper understanding of the context is what's needed. And I can honestly say a lot of big UN groups are probably not as well known for some of those type of things, at least on the humanitarian side. And I think the context has changed in the sense of you actually can't go into these humanitarian responses without having a deeper understanding of the context. And so, again, not so much innovative, but the idea of, wait a minute, just shoving it off the back of the truck is not really going to have the impact that we're going to do. We might save the babies and some of that, but we're not doing enough. And again, this is something that's been known for a while, but I think the last 5 or 6 years, you've really seen some more focus on this, because in these protracted these crises in some of these locations, the UN, other entities, the NGOs on the ground, and the community itself are asking to go that next step. And so what are some of those next steps? I think one thing that I think WFP has a particular advantage of, depending upon the context, is actually bolstering existing government systems. And in a sense, it's making that social protection system that exists more functional. Mm. And I think that there is a pretty good body of research that there is an amount of social cohesion that comes from social protection in and of itself, whether that be food security or otherwise. And so if there's a movement or a fledgling ability to do it in a given community that can be bolstered by the presence of the WFP team working through with, in conjunction, alongside, whatever we want to use, with the local entity, and whether that be national, federal, or even at that local side, we are seeing way more impact. We're seeing way more buy-in from the community. And even for all of those USAID people out there, a self-policing of who gets what and how this happens, which really does do this. Now, again, this is not a revolutionary thing, but I think because of the longevity of the crises we're seeing, there is the time to look at this a little differently and say, we need a more holistic approach, very much like what Katie was saying. I mean, food security in general is multifaceted. And I think providing the response is now becoming a little bit multifaceted as well. But the local context is important. So where there is no government, there has to be a different thing, going more directly to those established community leaders in that type of situation to, again, build that social protection angle, which leads to a better social protection, a better social cohesion.
So you've actually provided a great segue to the topic of fragility. You touched on fragility and on enduring crisis. Indeed, the World Bank's, according to the World Bank, at the end of 2020, over 80% of acutely food insecure people lived in fragile and conflict-affected states. And I dare say it wouldn't surprise me if that number is the same, if not even a little bit higher, given where we are today. So I would ask each of you, I know we said we weren't going to focus on challenges, but I think given the significance of this, to first sort of talk a little bit about what the challenges are that are associated with working on improving food systems when you're working in fragile and conflict-affected states. But then after that, also talk a little bit about what kinds of progress we're seeing. And actually, I think the theme of innovation is going to string through this entire conversation. So if you can also highlight innovative solutions when working in fragile and conflict-affected environments, I think that would be very helpful. So let's start again with you, Anne, if I could, on both of those questions.
Sure, and thanks for flagging those numbers about the overlap between fragile and conflict contexts and food insecurity. And what that means for people on the ground is that kids are eating less, parents are eating less, women eat last and least. These can have long-term implications of food security in communities. And I think your question was sort of what are the problems? And you have lack of trust. Traders are not going to communities. Your market systems can collapse, which I know we're all going to be talking about. So the solutions in that is you got to build trust. And you have to help support those market systems and not undercut them so that people can continue to work and thrive, and you get those food, you get that fertilizer, you get those improved seed varieties out to families on time before the rains come, before when you need to plant. So I think some of the examples, we had a great program on resilience and peace building in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where we brought together communities that had no trust with each other. And help build, and it was a food security program, but building peace communities and training mediation between different communities so that you could get trade started again. Because as we all know, you can have food 10 miles away, but if you can't get to it, you're still hungry. So how do you really help make sure you build that trust again with the market systems that can continue so that food is on the table and that you're continuing the economic activities that are happening. And as Matt was saying, we know how to do this. A lot of this is where's the funding and the assistance, and that we need that recognition that, yes, we can, even in fragile states, have some of this advancement. So I just want to briefly, this is on point, but slide aside, and really thank Congress for $1 billion in supplemental development funding that we got when Russia invaded Ukraine. And the world, the food security and fertilizer, it was a disaster. A huge percentage of the world's calories were kind of taken off the market overnight. We all know about the impacts. But thanks to $1 billion in supplemental funding for development, so not the humanitarian, but development, and using the platform of Feed the Future, we were able to get funds out quickly to continue to keep markets opening and operating, and to avert a lot of really could have been potentially damaging. Asset reducing your assets, but that in real life that means like having to eat your seed corn and doing that. The negative coping mechanisms basically means not sending your kids to school, especially your girls, and eating your gosh darn seed corn. So thanks to that development funding and the platform that we have through Feed the Future, I think we're really able to help mitigate a lot of that crisis. And and prevent even more stress on an already very overstretched food system.
So Katie, I want to have you fill in a little bit more on that. So first, we've identified some of the challenges, lack of trust, negative coping mechanisms that develop. What are some of the other challenges that you've seen from your vantage point at Mercy Corps? And again, also, sort of where have you seen some successes in these particularly challenging environments?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the biggest challenges when we're looking at fragility is that fragility, unfortunately, does not respect borders. A lot of the times you see fragility as a contagion, whether the way in which it can spread to other communities, other countries, cross-border, cross-line, which can move in a lot of different ways, unfortunately, especially when you are looking at economic trade routes, at ag capacity building, and the ways in which food and products move across borders. I think one of the examples of that is even in our own hemisphere. Mercy Corps has worked for years in Haiti in a variety of capacities, including with smallholder farmers. And mango is the second largest export crop from Haiti after coffee and is a huge source of income for small producers in the country. About 95% of mango exports go to the United States from Haiti. However, since November of 2022, I believe, the U.S. has suspended mango exports from Haiti because of the persistent insecurity in Haiti does not allow USDA inspectors to come in and work and provide the assurances of the phytosanitary standards that are required to export to the United States. So that's an example, I think, of where fragility can have those broader knock-on effects, unfortunately, even outside the immediate impacts of insecurity or gang violence, say, on an individual farmer's security on his own land. So to try to be a little bit more positive in terms of where we have seen some successes, I think looking upstream has been one of the things that Mercy Corps has really focused on. You know, we talk about fragility as a continuum, and there are many ways in which a cookie can crumble, but there are ways in which we can head off fragility at the pass, certainly. And so, for example, in northern Uganda, in a region called Karamoja, we had seen an increase in cattle rustling and in petty thievery, which was starting to get into not so petty thievery. So our approach there was to improve both the market access and natural resource management. We found out that a lot of the reasons for the cattle rustling was because of a lack of access to other goods and services, including grazing land and agricultural productivity. And so by going in and supporting the community to mediate amongst itself to better manage the natural resources in the area actually reduced the incidence of cattle rustling and looked to really start with those individual pieces of women's groups, of individual mediation and negotiation at a local level, and then we're able to actually then integrate that into the local governance structure. So finding ways in which even when we are not initially working directly with the local government, we can find ways to support and even strengthen that local governance capacity.
So Matt, I want to turn to you. The World Food Program is engaged in maybe some of the most acute and difficult conflict and fragile environments in the world. Why is it important for all of us as an international community to be focused on these kinds of situations? I mean, help bring home for those in the audience. I'm sure it's clear, but I think it bears, given the significance of the challenges we see in the world, why is it important for the international community to engage on these things? And what, when we see improved food security, you know, what does that translate to in terms of other kinds of progress in even the most fragile and acutely acute conflict area zones. What does that translate to?
So just to take it on the, I guess, the food security level, you know, conflict has become the major driver for food insecurity. And it's in many forms, and it's really in all the hemispheres now in differing ways. And of course, it is compounded by economics and weather patterns and other things as well. But really, conflict has come out. And again, I referenced earlier a little bit of the changing dynamics of some of these humanitarian emergencies, or the conflicts. They're lasting longer. They're more intractable. And you know, here we are at the U.S. Institute of Peace. I mean, finding peaceful solutions has become more difficult, or at least maybe there are less political actors willing to engage. Maybe that's part of it. And so a lot falls on to, I think, humanitarians to figure ways forward. And that also leads to all the bad things from conflict, like higher numbers of displacement. There's your most vulnerable. There's your most, you know, destabilizing force that's out there, with masses of people that are moving across borders or within countries. We've seen it, you know, since Syria 15 years ago, just the impact of what we are now seeing in Lebanon. I mean, it is not unforeseen, but I think a lot of us in the humanitarian community just kind of sit there on our hands and watch this all happen. And so what I see, like, the first 5 years of the Syria conflict to now, well, maybe not today now, maybe like a year ago, or a couple of years ago, is knowing the situation we're in, the humanitarian side, instead of focusing on the food security defined as household food security, and how does that household keep the baby from getting, you know, poor nutrition, to looking at it more systematically. How do we actually, you know, I think there's an impression, I know I had this impression until I went to certain places, that when there's these large-scale conflicts, everything stops. Well, in actuality, there really is engineering people, mostly women, who are still trying to actually farm, still trying to actually make markets work, still trying to obviously feed their families. And so how do we encourage that in a way that isn't going to put them in danger, but still give that local, already existing resilience there so a kick in the pants? And so instead of, like, figuring out how do we get another 500 tons of wheat into a given place, what about, like, giving them some farm implements? And we're talking ongoing conflict, but we're talking a changing the dynamic to say, you know what, this investment, we might only get like a 40, 60% payoff in terms of what we're going to do, but this is actually going to have the farms and tools, you know, the seeds and tools type of thing is actually going to be more effective in this situation given what's going on. Now, you buffer that with nutrition support and other things, you've actually got a pretty good program. Mm-hmm. You're maintaining some base level in Syria of production capacity that is being utilized way more effectively internally than any external inputs can have. Now, can we, the humanitarian community, be flexible enough to jump onto those opportunities? The other thing, when conflicts seem to get between one or two sides and it's intractable and things aren't moving, it's those governments themselves, if we can call them government, how about those ruling bodies, that are asking for those inputs as well. Now, one could argue, aren't you perpetuating what's going on? And you say, no, we're not. We're actually keeping a base level of ag economy going that can more easily bounce back whenever you all put away your toys and get along better, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So in actuality, it is actually a more effective in terms of external inputs only going in. You're building on what's there, and you're building that already inherent resilient, if we use that word, kind of capacity. And I think there's not a huge amount of those examples, but Syria is a really good one, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm.
So I want to move away from the topic of conflict and look more at adverse climate impacts as an entry point to the part of the discussion where I hope we can dive a little bit more into questions around innovation and adaptation. Another statistic, 80% of the world's hungriest people live in disaster-prone countries. And so that highlights, I think, the need for innovative approaches for adaptation to these various environmental changes that are occurring. So I'd ask each of you, and I'll start with you, Anne, to just talk a bit about, you know, how we can support communities. First, in the front end, we talked a bit, you know, all of you have given different examples of some of the agricultural practices that are at play. How do we support communities that are really on the front lines of these changes? And what are some of the innovations that have proven successful in terms of, and again, I know this has been touched on, but altering the ways in which communities are able to continue or produce even stronger yields despite these conditions? And finally, because we haven't talked about the private sector yet, but I think that this would be a good time to start that part of the conversation, to the extent each of you have examples of how the private sector is playing important roles in innovating, that would be helpful as well. So Anne, let's start with you on that.
Sure. So Sub-Saharan Africa faced a horrible drought. El Nino decimated much of crops in Zambia and Malawi and other parts of Sub-Saharan Africa, to the point that governments declared national disasters. I was there in February in Zambia, and if you were on a farm that we were working with they were diversified, you can't just grow maize, you diversify crops, you had the right type of varietal of seed, and I'd note in a good chunk of countries in Sub-Saharan Africa, varieties are 30 years old. Mm. So they have not been updated, so they are not drought tolerant, they're not flood, they're not heat tolerant. 30-year-old, when we need to be changing, with the impacts of climate change are happening now, yields are going down 30%, we're projected in the next couple of decades, we've got to have the right varieties. But if farmers had the right varieties, the right practices, and that this is not rocket science. Matt's point earlier, where it's like, yeah, these are all the new becomes old and old becomes new again. This is planting a little bit differently or in the right different way so that you can retain more moisture in the soil, different types of beds, intercropping, smart practices, and again, the diversification, and that farmers planted at the right time because they had the right climate information system. I'm going to get back to that because that's so important. Then farmers that we met with, they were going to be fine this year versus neighbors who their maize was here and there was no corn, there was nothing there for them to eat. So we can, this is as depressing as hell story, but this is actually that there is hope that if we can get that mix and that recipe of all of those things and an enabling environment with a government to be able to make sure the right private sector policies are there so the inputs are actually available and affordable, then you can get good, interesting packages of inputs to farmers that they can afford, that you have off-takers for these for products. And that's a private sector. Like, you can nudge the private sector, but they'll figure that out themselves. Mm-hmm. So that combination, it's not rocket science, but my goodness, it makes a huge difference in families and if kids are going to be able to survive and not have a really horrible lean season. The climate information services is so critical. 60% of Africa does not have access to early warning systems. So you don't know if it's safe to send your kid to school. You don't know when's the right time to plant. And if you don't, with rains and coming at different times, it's devastating. So getting out climate information services more to communities, I think, is just something that the broader community writ large, we need to get smarter on. And I'm really proud. The President's Emergency Plan for Adaptation Resilience, or PREPARE, has a whole pillar on knowledge is power and focuses on how do we get knowledge like this, like, okay, I got to wait 2 more days to plant. It's going to make a huge difference. So that's the Sub-Saharan Africa piece and those innovations of those seeds and everything out in bundled packages through some Feed the Future programming that made a huge difference. And we had really diverse partners. I had to get, it wasn't just, we worked with Simit, we had everybody. We had 1 acre, and we had all these local SMEs and amazing seed companies. So it took more than a village. It took a lot of people. And I want to flag just on the private sector side, but also the trade point that we've sort of been talking about. So if we don't keep borders open, it really can have a shock to the system. We saw that in 07 and 08 when people started shutting borders. I think one of the successes that we've had diplomatically over the last couple of years is during all these food crises, most borders stayed open. And in Zambia, at this height of the price spikes, that thanks to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Zambia kept its grain flowing with exports to Kenya and help stabilize Kenya's local grain prices. 2 years later, thanks to this horrible El Nino, I shouldn't say thanks, that's the wrong term, but because of this horrible El Nino, Zambia's maize yields were really low. Well, guess what? Then Uganda and Tanzania helped relieve some of the stress. And that kept people, that there was food availability, because there's often food right next door. But if you don't have the right policies in place, you don't have the right phytosanitary situation that needs to be supported and enabled by governments, then you can really have a tough situation. So the importance of both trade and then that bundling and supporting that private sector, again, just a little nudge sometimes and support can really help get all these smart innovations and good seeds that are current from this century into the hands of farmers can make a big difference.
So Katie, how does this challenge, or the notion of building innovation and adaptation in the face of environmental disruption, what does that look like from Mercy Corps' vantage point?
Sure. So two examples come to mind. One is, well, I'm calling it old, and another one is new. Old makes me feel even older because I was here when I was at USAID when we were pushing for it in the first place. But that is the relatively simple thing, and as a US-based policy nerd, I will say that digging into the funding aspects and the policy and what is permitted and what is not is really can make a big difference. And the inclusion by USAID of crisis modifiers in their agreements, which allows for a surge, essentially, when we start seeing some unanticipated or, I don't know, the known unknowns start to creep in, whether it is an influx of fighting, whether it is a bad drought or flood, being able to surge and pivot programming without having to reinvent the wheel, without having to start from scratch, because our staff is the one that is already on the ground. We've probably already partnered with local organizations who are light years ahead of us, who are already responding to whatever has come up. And so being able to not just have crisis modifiers baked into agreements ahead of time, but then actually kind of getting the muscle memory going so that people are used to using the crisis modifiers and not seeing that as a failure, but rather this was our insurance policy, and we are now using that insurance policy to keep things from getting worse or to lose the gains that we had been seeing, for example, in the first couple of years of a project. So that is kind of a seemingly simple, but increasingly a very tried and true innovation. I think one of the other things on the newer side that Mercy Corps has worked with, and this also goes to Mona, your question about the private sector, is in Latin America, remittances are a huge source of economic growth and drivers and support for individuals, families, and communities. Those funding flows are critical, much more so, frankly, than ODA. And so we sought to try to bring that information as power aspect that Anne was talking about to remittances. And so we partnered with a remittance financial services provider who facilitates the sending of money from individuals back to their families, communities, etc. And we worked in the information system about when weather shocks and stresses were going to be coming. So if there was a hurricane predicted, if there was flooding anticipated, even the difference of a day or two or three for that alert to go to those who usually send remittances to send money early or to send money ahead of time actually reduces the overall cost, because if you're able to prepare, that anticipatory action really does make a huge difference. And that's one where you know, the cumulative effect of seemingly small remittance funding can make an incredible impact in the immediate term, so in the immediate aftermath or prior to or after flooding, but also helps build that longer term resilience and capacity of a given community, which hopefully will improve the attractiveness of staying in the community and reduce the reliance on remittances long term.
So Matt, I want to have you maybe come at this question from the community perspective? And in particular, kind of how does WFP look at adaptations, or how do you address kind of from the community level helping to adapt practices in order to address issues around food insecurity or to make for more efficient agricultural practices?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that the information sharing, like the network, building those networks is really where I think we're going to see much more impact. And I think the early warning information to make it actionable to people, so getting that information. Mm-hmm. And I think that, actually, I think a lot of players play that role. WFP can be pretty large and at scale and can reach a lot. But I think if we're talking like new approaches or being able to adapt to things that are coming, it really is trying to get that information. I think we're learning more and more about it. And in this age, being able to help expand those networks is really where that is. And WFP has a pretty good net. And so getting more people onto that, getting that connected. You talked about like, well, once with the private sector, we don't have to worry about it. And I think that in certain, whether conflict or not, we have found some of the most efficient ways to ensure that people get access to food is really to juice up the private sector. Mm-hmm. So maybe what we need to do is actually find some of the beneficiaries and get money to them, and even not that much, actually. Mm. And those markets will come. And so I think that there's a little less control of that, but way higher impact and way more efficient. And so, you know, pairing those at times, at the appropriate times, to have that impact is when needed, at least in terms of reaching people. And on the ag side, you know, WFP has, funded by a few big donors, the idea of this innovation lab. Mm-hmm. And a lot of which goes through there are like big guys coming in and saying, we have a new algorithm, you know, to revolutionize your food delivery. And like, okay, that's great. And one of the simplest ones was like, yeah, we got a translation app that allows you to talk in the local languages to get information out. It was like, holy crap, that one just really like had impact. Like on some of the, you know, West African dialects, like that one had way more impact and was able to like, boom, we put that in action and we were able to reach way more people with relevant information.
So I'm mindful of the time, and I want to make sure that, as promised, we bring the audience in with their questions. But I want to do, I don't know if this is fitting to call it lightning round, because it's a big question. But it is something that is going to, I hope, be a good problem that we all face, which is post-conflict stabilization and the role that rebuilding agricultural systems can play toward building peace and resilience within communities. So I'm mindful of time, but if each of you could just offer one brilliant insight on how we should be thinking about post-conflict stabilization and the role that rebuilding agricultural systems can play in fostering and in seeding coherence, social cohesion, and resilience within communities.
I'll try to be really quick. It's a great question. And you can Google RISE 1 evaluation, USAID, stands for Resilience in the Sahel Enhanced Program, RISE. And it was in this, it worked in the Sahel and helped build and bring together communities that have been beset by conflict, by climate, by horrible droughts, and you name it. But through investments, I think we were able to prove and had some really good analysis of how we help break some of that cycle of crisis and conflict, and helped reach almost 2 million of the peoples of the region's most vulnerable populations, increase their economic and well-being, and strengthen institution and governance, which you have to do, and improved health and nutrition. So this is in Burkina and Niger. We're really able to help. In areas where we worked, people become more food secure and more confident in their ability to recover from shocks. There's a pretty really good evaluation on how the percentage increase in sort of resilience indicators. So that's all DC or, you know, sort of talk for. Mm-hmm. People felt safer and better able to feed themselves and their families thanks to proven interventions, all we've talked about here. both in conflict and then afterwards. I would say, though, one of the best things with in post-conflict is don't let the markets, don't let the farmers, don't give up on them even during conflict, because you just starting from scratch again is very difficult. So don't fail the farmer. Continue to support them and the input providers throughout as much as possible.
Well noted. Katie?
Absolutely. Second that, and certainly building on Matt's point of market-based solutions. I think one of the things that we have seen in post-conflict engagement and recovery is really finding that not just balance, but integration of the social cohesion and psychosocial support and the identifying the identifying the shared concerns and the shared fractures within the community, as well as the shared needs of the community. All too often, we can focus just on bringing people together and singing kumbaya, and all too many times we can say, like, let's just, you know, put together a really great farming scheme and everybody's going to win and nobody's going to care about everything that happened in the community previously because we're all going to be making money hand over fist. That is a drastic oversimplification on both sides, but integrating those, we have found in a thoughtful way, really does provide that win-win that we're looking for. So for example, one of the ways that we have approached this is in Iraq, actually with returnees. So whether they are people who have been captured by ISIS and have been held, or have in some way been engaged, caught up with, separated from their communities and have now returned in a, you know, maybe post-conflict is too strong of a word for that, but in a post-conflict area, making sure that we are having those intra and intercommunal conversations alongside looking for ways to improve olive oil production. And so having both the shared goals of reintegration and having a, you know, if you want to say a rising tide lifts all boats or everybody wins, while at the same time not minimizing the very real trauma that underlies so much of the violence that has gone on, and ensuring that we are not burying those with economic support, but rather having economic support balanced with that social cohesion work that really can and should be integrated into each other.
So I want to just build on exactly that point and throw it to you, Matt, to look at and think about this same question and also sort of how do we ensure that food aid and agricultural investments in a post-conflict environment doesn't actually inadvertently fuel conflict, perhaps by being unaware of some of the very specific points that Katie brought up.
That's what is actually kind of going through my head. I think the general conflict assistance or food assistance or humanitarian assistance can actually go on too long sometimes, and that in and of itself can actually, you know, impact market or other development. I mean, really, actually across the board. And so I think being more cognizant of there's no switch that just says conflict's over and like let's all flood in, but I think we on the humanitarian side, whether it's lackadaisical laziness or just like this is where it works, let's just keep going, or also the fear to like do other things, whatever, or combination of all of those probably. It's too easy to fall back on like let's just do the needful instead of beyond the needful to change the situation. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the biggest is just continuing the system as opposed to knowing when to bring in those other outputs to look at it holistically, like what you were saying. That does not mean putting things under the carpet and not dealing with them, but there needs to be a more quick, and actually have seen more pivots, I think, earlier on in conflicts to do that. Even in Sudan right now, like, which is really horrible, there are people talking about, no, we need to get in there. We need to get some, those farmers, or it's going to be even worse than we think. So, and that's, those are discussions or even ideas that didn't happen, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. So I do feel that there is some recognition of that.
Very helpful. So I want to give the audience a chance to engage in the discussion and raise any questions or comments you might have. You can just raise your hand and we will get a mic to you and you could identify yourself and ask your question. Questions, comments? insights? Yes, right here, please. Okay.
Well, thank you all for an amazing day. I'm Peg Willingham, currently with Save the Children. Nice to see you all, but used to work for the CGIAR, and most people probably know the acronym, but anyway, Agricultural Research Network, and I just wanted to talk about security, though. China, I think, is investing some multiple of what the U.S. is in agricultural research, and I wonder if you all have any comments about what the U.S. should be doing to catch up. Thank you.
How do you catch up to China quickly around, across the row here?
I can speak to AIDS, our budget versus the domestic USDA and other side of it. But we're very and nice to see you. We're very proud of some of the commitments we made to the CG. We actually made a $315 million commitment that we met early at this previous COP. Over 5 years, because we know the value. It's that 1 in 10, like the return on investment. How do we get these innovations out to farmers, and having a really amazing centers working very deeply with countries on the problems that they're facing, especially around climate. So on the international side, I think we have stepped up to meet the moment, and are excited, even through this Aim for Climate, Agriculture Innovation Mission for Climate effort that's underway, that there's been new donors that have come in last year. The UAE and Gates both made matching $100 million contributions to the CG. And so, because we need to crowd in more, it is a global treasure and a global investments that we need to keep up with the too rapidly changing time.
Any other comments, Katie, Matt?
Just quickly, I think actually the U.S. is well geared to do this, and it's not a government initiative. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's our mighty farm economy, to be honest. And I think to toot WFP, since that's where I'm sitting now, I think the goal is going to be to take those continuing, you know, huge advances. We talked about some of them, seeds and drought control, and getting them to the people who need them. And I think that's going to be another thing that WFP, and I mean, WFP is not going to be the one to come up with new seeds, let's be honest. But we could probably get them to people who could use them pretty good. Like, we're pretty good at that. We partner with FAO, we partner with NGOs, we can do that. And I think ensuring that works well is a way, and again, I don't think we should say we're going to combat China, but we should be able to hold our own pretty well.
I think there was a question right here. Yes, here's a mic right behind you.
Hi. My name is Allison Brown. I'm a horticulture marketing specialist. I'd like to paraphrase Jane Austen. It's a truth universally acknowledged that a young person who has any other opportunity in life will not be engaged in agriculture. How are you addressing this problem?
Go in. Okay. Well, first, I am ashamed that we have not talked more about horticulture. I actually have a really good locally led adaptations example about horticulture that I could just flag on how we've worked over the last 10 odd years with an amazing Tanzania mission with a horticultural association that had, you know, just a handful of members, and now only got, they were sub to an international organization, then got a major grant, $24 million, the biggest of any of our economic growth office in Tanzania, because horticulture is so important. We have to have nutritious, all that we're talking, if it's not nutritious, if it's not safe, it's not food. So anyway, there's my little rant on horticulture, because know how important it is. But in terms of the youth, getting them into higher value crops like horticulture, we have a really cool, one of our innovation labs from Penn State has works with AI and sends out folks much smarter than I and younger than I with smartphones that take picture of pests that are moving into new areas because of climate change, sends it up to the AI and the cloud, but combines that technology with the smarts and ingenuity of youth to make ag sexy again. Like, how do we do this, right? So these dream teams of kids are going out and for very low cost, being able to address agricultural threats, and it's showing the coolness of the technology, and that we're empowering them also to help communities. So that's a sense of empowerment, a sense of self-worth too that's needed. So that's just one example. But hear you that we need to continue to do that, but we also need to give them the choice. That's also, it's farmers' choices on how they're gonna do things too.
Katie, how do we make ag sexy again?
When you find out, let me know, please. I'm convinced that it's sexy, but I'm just me. I certainly agree on that front, and I think it goes across the ag sector. I think one of the things that we have been working with is, especially with the impact of climate change on pastoralists and changing patterns, so even those youths, particularly young men, who would want to remain in that capacity are increasingly challenged to find that to be viable. And so finding the balance, like Anne said, of having it be a real choice and not forcing pastoralists unnecessarily to shift to agriculture, but rather looking for inventive ways to integrate the two or to improve some of the human conflict that has been only increased actually by the changing climate patterns, and looking for ways to improve those intercommunal ties that again make it more of a win-win. I would also point to similar to something that Anne said that we have done a lot of in Ethiopia and Somalia is kind of making it a both and or an additive situation where you are still able to maximize the productivity of your smallholder farmer land, but also either adding a stage of production. Having even just that next step of whether it's storage, whether it is seeds or others, being able to have that added value that increases the viability of that, you know, essentially small business long term, and makes it more appealing to young people in particular who are able to then have that diversification while still maintaining what we need and what their communities need, which is that agriculture capacity.
Matt, did you want to jump in on this? Okay. Other questions, comments? Yes, in the back. Here comes a mic right just behind you.
Thank you. Nicola Dyer, formerly of the World Bank. I used to manage the Global Agriculture and Food Security Program. Thank you very much for the U.S.'s support. And now I am very actively involved in aquatic foods, be it through the Global Seaweed Coalition or through the Aquatic and Blue Foods Coalition, which is one of the many coalitions which was formed after the UN Food Systems Summit. So food security obviously depends a lot on aquatic foods. And I haven't heard any mentions explicitly of aquatic foods, so now here's an opportunity to hear perhaps what some of your organizations are doing. So whether it's ocean-sourced food, or whether it's lakes, rivers, et cetera, and of course, seaweed, and the many ways that seaweed can contribute to food security, whether it's by food feed or biostimulants, improving fertilizers. So would love to hear from you. Thank you.
Who wants to jump in on that?
I can do a short one, but I'm looking. First, we've got some great Feed the Future programming on resilience on coastal areas. In Madagascar, and if I'm getting this right, yes, I'm forgetting the acronym, but it's reeling with resilient communities and also helps make sure that sustainably catching is very important, but then also the food loss and waste is horrible. We lose a third of all food around the world, either wasted or lost, depending on where along the supply chain. And fish have such good protein. There's such good protein. When we have a Feed the Future Innovation Lab for fisheries out of Mississippi that does amazing things. It's worked to make sure that you can take dry fish and then get that and crumble it and put it into food. And kids, the nutritional gains for children is amazing. So doing more of that, but getting and how this gets that value added that Katie was talking about is making sure that we're investing in the whole supply chain, so we're not wasting fish or other meats and dairies and obviously vegetables. But that's, I think, is really key. So we've looked closely at a lot of that. Have some good programming in Ghana and Senegal. We've also done some fishery work through Feed the Future because it is such an incredibly important food source in gosh, what is a billion? Nicole, you know this better than I. The stats are very impressive on how much we should be focusing on it and keeping it sustainable too for future use. Thanks.
And I'll just say real quickly, I'm going to toot another organization's horn, not my own, but one of the other things that we've certainly seen is looking to retain the importance of aquaculture in communities that already, that is their locally preferred source of protein, that is the culturally appropriate source of food. And so, for example, in Cambodia, CARE is actually working with some local producers to develop essentially a fish cake in replacement of, we've all seen the incredible value of RUTF around the world, which has been largely focused on inputs such as peanuts and other grains. That is not the preferred source in that part of the world, in Cambodia. And so being able to look for, the way that Anne was talking about, reducing food waste, making sure that we are being responsive to the local community's needs and preferences and opportunities, and being able to see the creativity and the innovation of what is, we've all seen as such a truly life-saving intervention for those who are malnourished and suffering from stunting and wasting, but doing it in a way that is both culturally appropriate and more sustainable in some ways.
Matt, did you want to jump in on this?
No, to be honest, I actually think it's a little overlooked in a lot of these activities that are going on. I mean, I remember groundbreaking stuff in Bangladesh with, both coastal and inland that had way more impact on, the household nutrition with a functioning fish pond, but then combined with that. So I think at that level, we still see it, but I also do think that there's a lot of commercial entities that still kind of play there, whether negative or not, and I think that's probably part of it, when you're looking at the big ocean stuff. It seems to be more like a resource that, that WFP gets attacked if they think we're a fishing trawler, with our ships going across. It's like, we're just doing food. So, I mean, I know that still happens, but I do think that there's probably not enough attention, and I don't think, to be honest, WFP plays enough there.
Well, with that, I want to thank the three of you for what has been a very rich discussion. We've covered a lot of ground. There was more to cover, but maybe that's for another time. Please join me in thanking our three excellent panelists.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.